Exit number 11938, Rail 10.
Will you go on with your story of the Arras attack, Mr. Eyston?
Well, I crawled out of the ditch, out the road, sunken road, about 50 yards into the field in front of me. I then crawled down between the tanks. Peter Jeffers was already there, throwing his hand grenades wherever he could get them to go. But I went through the tanks, and I had one idea, was to get back to the CO and see if he could get the tanks back to fight the tanks, because we had no anti-tank guns. And the four RNS poor sods, I was really sorry about, they really upset me. I mean, there's too many in these things, they couldn't get out, they couldn't do anything. And every time they wanted a bit more light, they just blew one up and two men went. So I had one idea, was to get the tanks back. And I knew where the CO was, so I crawled between the tanks. And after I broke cover from the tanks, I ran down and picked my truck up on the other side of the crossroads and headed north to Agincourt. What I didn't realise was that to get to the CO, I'd got to go across two railways. And in my haste, I got fast on one of the railways, and I left the truck there and climbed up the embankment, the railway embankment, and got to the CO. Now, again, I got this experience of a dejected man. In fact, it reminds me of the photos of Napoleon when he was completely beat with his greatcoat on, and Colonel Miller was the same, looking out towards where the RNF vehicles were going up, and a really dejected man. He was uncomfortable to think about, really. However, I got to him and I said, "Can we get the tanks back, sir?" He says, "No, I don't think we can get the tanks back." So I turned to walk away, and he shouted, "Eyston, you're hurt." So I was bleeding a bit from the left leg, but I was still mobile as far as I was concerned. And I said, "Oh, it's nothing, sir, I'm all right. I'll just go down, pick the truck up and go back to Major Jeffries." He says, "You won't." Well, I wasn't so worried about the truck. I was worried about all my stuff. I didn't have any pack or a greatcoat or anything again. They were all in the truck. And I said before about the Germans might have been cold. I started to feel cold then. And the leg started to get stiff.
Where had you got your injury?
In the left knee.
And how would that occur?
Now, this is a thing. This is something I've missed out completely. Laying in this ditch, and as mentioned about the RNF cars going up fairly regularly, I looked down this gun and right down the barrel. I thought there was a bloke behind that watching me. And I must have sat there for, I should think a minute, looking down the barrel. I thought, well, that's the end of George. You know, I thought, he couldn't miss. The way I looked at it, it was impossible for him to miss. And he fired, and I didn't notice anything. I was crawling down between the tanks before I realised that I was hurt. This is a fact, as I said about the corporal early on. He didn't really know he was hurt. For all his jaw was hanging down, he didn't really know that he was hurt. All he wanted to do was, "Get up the bastards, let me get up the bastards." I'll always remember that, I think.
Coming back to Colonel Miller, you say he was dejected. How exactly did it show itself? Was he, would you say he was exhausted?
He was exhausted. He'd been badly shelled, dive bombed in Agincourt. He knew D Company had been badly dive bombed in Borains. I mean, you could see it, you see, from Agincourt, and it's fairly high. You could see what was happening. And he'd also been down to the crossroads. I don't think he stayed there very long, quite honestly, but he had been as far as the crossroads and seen that we were pulling back to the crossroads. And quite honestly, I think that with me coming back wounded, he's worried about Peter, Major Jeffries. And because he hadn't seen him, I hadn't seen him, apart from a few seconds. I hadn't seen him, and I was supposed to be with him. And I hadn't seen him from leaving at 11:30 since the march started. Now, when we started the tape in the middle of tape 7, I tried to emphasise what these lads had gone through. Now, since starting this attack, they had advanced 12 miles. That is after about 6 hours sleep. Well, you couldn't call it sleep because they were in trenches. They only had their great coats, so you couldn't call it sleep. And that was after 4 days without any sleep. In fact, it was about 8 days without any sleep, really. And they were in really good form, even for all they'd been dive bombed in Borains. They were still in quite good form. But when they tried to move them from Borains, I think they had got a little bit sick, because I think this keep on retreating got to them a bit. You know, they had the idea, well, we've got here, why can't we stop here? And if the artillery had come up, the anti-tank guns had come up, and the 25 pounds had come up alongside us and blasted a few off, that would have given a different feeling altogether. So now I've got a bit of the feeling that Peter Jeffries had in the morning. It's not so much what's happening to you, it's what you were doing as well. And if you're not doing much, it's bad. If you're just sat there and retaliating, it's a bad thing. It's just like when the Navy guns came at Alamein. I mean, you saw those guns with their half-done shells, and they were such a flash that you know, it lifted. You say, well, they can't live through that, and we've got to get through it. If the 25 pounds had come through and done something with us, I don't think it'd been much problem. You know, we could have done a lot of damage. Because for all the 88s are a wonderful multi-purpose gun, our artillery, our 25 pounds, are pretty accurate when they get them set up and going properly. And if they'd come through and sort of just backed us a little bit, even if they'd been 5 or 6 miles back and firing over our heads, something going the other way, instead of all coming to us, it would have been different. If there had been some macaque, I mean, yes, we had our arcac. I mean, two Bren guns. You've got to change a barrel every 10 magazines. You know, it's really stupid. am I drifting off a bit?
No, it's fine what I'm saying. The Colonel Miller was obviously affected by this just as course as the men were being affected.
I think even more so. Even more so. Because he was a TA man, true enough. But he'd studied warfare, and he was a good CO. And I think there was a terrific link between him and Peter Jeffries, Major Jeffries. I think there was a terrific link. And I think with me going back as Major Jeffries' driver Batman, me going back and asking for tanks, it must have sort of realised how desperate the situation was.
Did you get the feeling that battalion headquarters were in a bad way at that time as a headquarters?
I only saw him. He was the only man. The only one I saw, that's what I said. He was like Napoleon out on his own, and he was looking at the battle as he saw it from Agincourt. No doubt he knew just where everything was and where everything should be. And when I told him we were being attacked by tanks, that was sort of the... I won't say the end, it wasn't the end, by any means, but it was a blow to him, a big blow.
But he was quite lucid.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. But he frankly refused to let me go. He wouldn't even let me go and get my truck where all my gear was.
So what did you do then?
Well, he finally did get rid of somebody, and they lifted me onto the engine cover of one of the scout cars. Well, it was a 4RNF scout car or not, I don't know, but And if you want the cover, or the scout car, and we went off somewhere. From there, I'm more or less lost. I do know that the next morning, we were going through a place, and it could have been Armentières. And the Stukas were dive bombing the cemetery, the military cemetery. And that hurt. No doubt, it was a queer situation. It was a bit like an hairpin.
This would be the First World War cemetery.
Yes, right? Yeah. You came down the road and then you sort of doubled back at an angle. It was like just like an hairpin. A single hairpin, not a double hairpin, but a single hairpin. And the cemetery was right in the corner of this hairpin. And as we were going through, the dive bombers were bombing it. Now, maybe they were hoping to bomb the road, I don't know, but the bombs were actually falling in the cemetery as we went past. I can't be certain, but I was feeling Armentières. By this stage, I think I was starting to do a little bit of passing out. And I can't remember, but I suppose at some stage I was put into a blood wagon and I finished up in Belgium somewhere. 2 days later, I got onto my feet. I'd obviously had the leg dressed and I got onto my feet. And I went for a stroll on crutches down the village. Again, I have no idea what they called the place. But the chemist shop was open. Not a soul in it. And there I did my only bit of looting. Because I didn't have a toothpaste, I didn't have a toothbrush, I didn't have a shaving thing. And I'll always remember the first time I'd ever seen it, and I haven't done much use for it since, was Lux toilet soap. And I don't think I've found anything as great anywhere. It's something that's always stuck with me, the white Lux toilet soap. And I don't know why, but I often think about this white soap. I have seen it since, but it's not the sort of stuff you would go for. But that particular day, it was terrific. So that was my only bit of looting, really. It was open. I suppose the Germans would be in it after we left. I don't know. Everybody would be in it. But I didn't have a toothbrush, shaving gear or anything. You see, it was all in the truck, in my little pack.
Just to go back to the attack before we leave it. What are the feelings of yourself in a situation where there's so much noise and so much danger? Were you given thoughts to, will I get out of this?
I don't think so. I suppose at heart we're all optimists. Now, I must admit that later on, as a general feeling, not particularly in an attack, but most of us didn't expect to live beyond 23. We thought if we lived beyond 23, we're on a bonus. I mean, we're lads that went in at 18 and 19. And not at the time of Alice, but later on in the war, a lot of us talked and we said, well, if we get to 23, we're on a bonus. And there was this feeling that, if you got to 23, you'd had your luck. A lot of poor lads didn't get to 19. But, no, I don't think, I think we're all optimists at heart. We all think we'll get through.
Do you recall any... Do you have any recollections of other officers than Major Jeffries in this attack and their behaviour? Did you come across any?
Oh, I came across a lot of them. In fact, I had Mr. Surtees, he's caught in the back of the truck. Bill Surtees, he'd been with B Company and then he went to be the intelligence officer. And his coat was in the back. I had somebody else here. Oh, I knew a lot of them. And I don't think there was any real fear in them at all. We all knew what could happen. We all knew that it could happen to anybody. But you had this feeling that if your name's on the bullet, well, the bullet will get you. And that's the attitude that I think everybody took. As I've said, if you heard the shell go over, that wasn't yours. That was somebody else's. If you had a bullet go past you, that wasn't yours, that was somebody else's. If you didn't hear it, it might be yours. But we all had this feeling that if your name was on it, yes, it would happen. Now, one thing I would like to say here, I don't think I've mentioned it before. My father came from a religious family. And my uncle had been, I suppose, a conscientious objector in a sense that he didn't believe in killing. And he had gone in the medical corps during the First World War. So he knew what a blight he was. And I'm told that on two occasions when they knew that we were in action, real serious action, that family sat down and they prayed all night that I would get a blighty one. And on two occasions I did. So I didn't know this at the time. I mean, my wanting to pray had nothing at all to do with that. It was just... I don't know how you explain it, really. You've got to have faith in something. And for all, I won't say I was wanting anything like that, I was a lad, just like most people were. But what shocked me was that I couldn't remember the Lord's Prayer at that particular stage. And it took me 4 days later when I was in Belgium that I fished the little Gideon's Bible out and found it. I think it's Matthew 14 that it's in. And then I was happy then, and I've used it ever since.
During the action and your wanderings around the battlefield, did you get any opportunity to talk to any men, officers, NCOs about the situation as it was at that time? You know?
I don't think so. I knew that I had to try and get the Major Jeffries with the message that the attack was called off and we had to concentrate around Borains.
Where did you get that message from?
From when I was at advanced headquarters, taking prisoners back, and I knew that.
Taking wounded, sorry.
No, I didn't take any prisoners, apart from the seven that I mentioned. Prisoners weren't in my field, apart from... and they weren't in my field. It was somebody who was thrown at me. No, wounded, when I was taking
so
wounded back.
So you got this order to take back to Major
Jeffries? And I think somebody else did come through with the message eventually because I was held up somewhere and somebody else had got the message through eventually. Instructions and messages were really serious. I can't remember the DRs being up with us at all. And really, it's not cutting 40 yards, just like me with a wheel truck. France doesn't lend itself really to DRs. And I don't remember the Germans coming up with many motorbikes in that particular area either. I can't remember seeing any Germans on motorbikes in that area because it wasn't really suitable for the bikes. It was all right for the trucks.
What kind of countryside were you fighting over?
Well, as you know, in France there are very few hedges, so it's open. But instead of hedges, they've got these roads that sort of divide fields or paths that divide fields, and they're either down or they're up. In most cases, they're down, so to get across them, you've got a problem with a wheel vehicle. As I said, the tracks, they could just go over them and bounce and they're off the other side. But for a wheel vehicle, you've got a job getting across them. And I suppose at that time, there were very few tractors on the go, so the horses, they would go along these sunken tracks and then they would climb up and over the top and do whatever they had to do over the top. I don't know now, last time I was there, I think there was still loads of sunken roads. And most have tractors now, surely. Or maybe they don't, I don't know, because they're all small units, aren't they? They don't have big units that like we do. So I don't know.
Could you see the German positions firing on you at any stage?
Well, the stupid thing I thought about afterwards, that my seven prisoners were the blokes that had been firing at me. I didn't think about it at the time, but afterwards when I was laid in hospital and these things come back to you and you keep having nightmares about these things, because don't let us forget that the battle doesn't stop once it's won or lost. The battle with the men keeps going back years and years and years after. In fact, I had a cousin who was in the submarines and he was still screaming 20 years after. Just wake up and scream his head off through the night. He'd had another of his nightmares. So these things, they keep coming back, and it's frightening in a sense. I'm clear now, I think.
Did you come across any men who'd suffered from, for want of a better word, shell shock or anything during this action?
I don't remember many suffering shell shock, not in this stage. Later on there was lots, because shells got bigger as the war went on. I think maybe there were two. I can't recall them now. I think maybe there were two who were pretty well shocked. But the big corporal out of C Company, he was berserk. He wasn't really shocked, he was just berserk. And, you know, when a man gets like that, it takes a lot of people to hold him down. In fact, I was wishing I had a needle I could have chapped him with at the time, but I didn't.
For the action there, Mr. Eisen, what was it?
The military medal, MM, and that was awarded for recovering and transporting wounded back to the MO during every shell fire.
And how was that awarded to you? How did you get it?
Through the post. Now, we'll refer to this a few times as the story goes on, but at Lytton Cheney, it was gazetted. It's gazetted in the London Gazette, and that's the first that we really know about it. It's like the birthday honours. I suppose somebody knows, but you don't know officially until it's gazetted, and then it comes out. And at Lytton Cheney, I was given a new uniform and did these saluting drills and all the rest of it. In fact, I spent a couple of days at Purbright with the guards, preparing for this visit to the palace to collect the medal. But the palace was bombed the week before, so my medal came through the post. The postman presented it with the rest.
And there were other medals awarded for this particular action?
Yes, Captain Cummins, a D Company, he got the Military Cross. Second Lieutenant Blackman, he was a Military Cross. Captain Heslop, the MO, he was a Military Cross. Tommy Palace. Now, Tommy was a sergeant, and well, he was a sergeant when he was awarded the medal, but later he became Sergeant Major of B Company, and Tommy and I were quite good pals. And the Lance Corporal Bowstead, I think he was an 8th Battalion lad, and a Private Puddle. Private Puddle and a companion were separated from the comrades, and they took shelter in the house to escape the attack from the enemy tanks. Private Puddle's companion was wounded, so he carried him across the open fire to a truck and drove it to safety.
Was he?
No, Lloyd never driven before. He was 8th as well. Yes, so thus Bowstead and Puddle, they were 8th, and then myself drove the second command through heavy shelling, and was sent to find the MO and ambulance and successfully guided them forward to deal with casualties. He then collected wounded men until he was himself wounded. Throughout, he showed great coolness and initiative under heavy fire. Not bad.
So, you're in the hospital at Belgium. What was your next move from there?
Well,
whilst we're on this Belgium question, whilst you were in the hospital in Belgium, was there any indication from the people around you, the civilians, that they knew the war was going very badly against them?
I don't remember a great deal about it, to be quite honest. The incident I did remember was going and getting a toothbrush and the rest of it so that I could get myself cleaned up a little bit. There was a lot of very badly wounded in there, and quite honestly, I felt a bit of an imposter when you saw so many badly wounded, and I could hobble on sticks. I could get around, and you felt that you couldn't really ask for any sympathy in the hospital because there were so many so much worse than I was, and I suppose, really, most of my time was spent sleeping. I was stiff. I was very, very stiff.
Was this a military hospital?
Yes. A military hospital. I think it was a school that had been taken over. It was in this village because the chemist shop was just sort of went out the door of the hospital or up into the street, and the chemist shop was only a few yards down. I couldn't get very far because that time I'd got really stiff, and it was like a peg leg rather than a leg. There was very little bending in me at all. And I did manage to get down to this chemist shop, and I think most of the time there I slept. I suppose then we're talking about the 22nd, 23rd, possibly. And we got something to eat, plenty, a fair amount to eat anyway. And I think for 2 days I basically slept. Whether I was drugged or not, I don't think I was drugged, but I could have been. I mean, there's no telling what they're doing, aren't you, when you're in hospital. And you get to the stage where you really pass caring what they're doing with you in any case, which I'm going to contradict in the next episode. So I don't remember a great deal about it. I think most of my time was spent sleeping. On the morning of the 26th, we were put in ambulance. Oh no, I moved somewhere else. I must have moved somewhere on the 23rd to another military hospital, probably further back, I don't know where. But I moved somewhere else to another military hospital establishment. And then on the morning of the 26th, we were put in the ambulance and taken to Dunkirk. We arrived there at night. Through the night, because there was traffic problems and one thing and another. And you can't see much from the ambulance. There's only a very little window on the side. However, I was stretcherized in that case, probably because I thought it was easier to be stretcherized than it was to have walking wounded. And as it was carried from the ambulance along the jetty, you could see Dunkirk burning all the way around. It was really fierce. In fact, there was something burning just again the jetty. I don't know what it was. And I was put on the hospital ship Palace. Hospital ship Palace. Obviously, that had been a cruise liner of some sort, converted into a hospital ship. Oh, and that was terrific. We got some real tea, a real cup of tea. And there were military nurses, and they were very good. And we came across to to Dover, and taken from the ship and carried on the stretchers to the ambulance train.
What was the reception getting off the ship?
Oh, terrific. Terrific. The WVS, I think it was WVS, were there. The Red Cross was there. NAFI was there. And cigarettes galore. It was terrific. Tea and a little bag of bits and pieces. I can't just remember what it was now. I don't think it was that one, but later on we got bags with bits of writing paper in. Obviously from that letter, there wasn't writing paper in that one. Yes, the reception was terrific. And eventually we got in the hospital train, no idea where we were going at all. And the train travelled throughout that night. And we finished up at Bromsgrove at the mental hospital. All the military hospitals were attached to mental hospitals. Setchfield was, Setchfield Emergency Hospital. That started out as part of the mental hospital. In fact, I was in the mental hospital wing at Setchfield, Ward 5, I think it was. But it had been detached from the mental hospital at that time. It was used as a military hospital. And Bromsgrove was part of a very big mental hospital. Because, as I've said a few times, that I had a little bit of nursing experience, and they were terribly short of staff, terribly. This hospital, the military side, had just been formed, And as far as I could see, there was the one doctor who was trying to do everything. And he was glad of any assistance he could get. So I was pegging along with my sticks and one thing and another and trying to help him wherever I could. But I kept getting this sharp bite in the back of my leg. And I couldn't understand it because I was wounded on the front of my knee, you see. I couldn't understand it, and eventually I had a word with him. I said, there's a terrible pain in the back of my leg. I can't understand what it can be. So I said, well, better have it x-rayed and have a look at it. And the front of the knee was damaged. I mean, we knew that, but I couldn't understand this pain at the back, and that was causing me the most trouble because it meant that I couldn't bend the knee properly. So I did x-ray, and there's a lump of shrapnel in the back of my knee. Now, whether that had worked its way around in a matter of a week or 10 days, from the front of the knee to the back of the knee, I just don't know. There's no sign of it going in at the back. Anyway, he gave me a shot and he got the lance out and